The following Dharma talk was given by Ron Hogan Green. Hogan Sensei is a lay teacher in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org.
Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. And welcome, and hello to those on one continuous thread. How do you go straight down an ever-changing, twisting path? This is from case 25 in the Blue Cliff Record, The Hermit of Lotus Peak. And the introduction says, if your potential does not leave its fixed position, you tumble down into the poisonous seas. If your words don't startle the crowd, you fall into the streams of the commonplace. If you can distinguish this from that, in the spark struck from a flintstone, if you can choose between killing and giving life in the flash of lightning, then you can cut off the 10 directions by your sitting and tower up like a wall of 1,000 fathoms. But how do you know if there is such a time? I will show you the example. Look. So the Hermit of Lotus Peak took up their staff and showed it to the assembly, saying, when the ancients got here, why didn't they continue to stay? The assembly was silent. He answered in their stead, saying, because they would have no power on the road. Again, he said, in the end, how is it? Once more, he answered in their place. With the staff across my shoulders and paying other people no heed, I go straight into the 1,000 and 10,000 peaks. The verse to this koan. Their eyes are all dust and sand, their ears all dirt. They dare not stay among the 1,000 and 10,000 peaks. Falling blossoms, flowing water, incessantly busy. Raising their eyebrows, where are they going? So in the introduction to this koan, it says, if your potential does not leave its fixed position, you tumble down into the poisonous sea. If your words don't startle the crowd, you fall into the streams of the commonplace. So your potential, if it doesn't leave its fixed position. What is your potential? We often hear that we all have the Buddha nature and that we can realize our true nature personally. Our insight into our true nature is realized in particular ways. It's not random. It doesn't happen of itself, in a sense. Our individual and collective karma and our dedication to the practice, our own awakening and the many factors that make up our individual lives, the choices we make now and along the way, and other unknowable factors all influence how and when we may awaken to our original face, each of us individually in our own way. We can live in such a way that we are stuck, even as our life changes. Or we can be deeply connected with bodhicitta, with the desire to realize ourselves and help others realize themselves, and have it inform us and how we live and practice. And we can move back and forth between these two perspectives. Probably we do. The Buddha's teaching on samsara and freedoms from samsara make it clear that to the extent we are asleep to our potential, we invite the poisonous sea to be our fundamental life experience. We may recognize it, we may not recognize that, but from a Buddhist perspective, that's what occurs. If your words don't startle the crowd, you fall into the streams of the commonplace. It's not just your words. It's not just what you do. It's how you live. In the most ordinary sense, and sometimes in the smallest of actions, how we live and how we understand what our life is about can startle the crowd. It's not that we're trying to startle or amaze anybody. It's just as we go deeper into our practice and the Dharma becomes us, we think and act from it. That's a different reference point than the crowd. And this is subtly taken in by people. It's noticed, sometimes often not overtly, but noticed. Master Dogen speaks of that when he talks about giving. He talks about how it is noticed when your generosity becomes you and you become your generosity. Why is that? A life sustained by our bodhisattva vows is not ordinary fare. It is different. The hermit of Lotus Peak took up their staff and showed it to the assembly, saying, when the ancients got here, why didn't they consent to remain here? What does the hermit mean by here? An essential question. And the master is bringing it up directly before us. Master Juzu, Gotai in Japanese, showed the world of essence by raising one finger in response to any question. Another master, any time a question was asked, would just turn his back. And of course, we all know about the Rinzai approach. When a question was asked, he would hit the student. Those are perhaps appropriate to those particular times and places and practitioners. Given this, the question is, when the ancients came here, why didn't they continue to stay here? And it's important to see that this hermit, who spoke many hundreds of years ago in China, is speaking directly to you, to us, directly. And this directness and our ability to be intimate with it is what can give a koan life, our life. Our hermit is pointing to a profound and actual moment of realization, or equally pointing to an understanding that from the first moment we sit, we are starting to realize our inherent nature, just as it is. how this ripens to a direct apprehension of our awakening is up to us, up to a practice, a desire to awaken, and to live out of that, to live out of our inherent wisdom, which can come forth. And no matter how we realize it, it's essential that we do realize it, even if it isn't measurable by us. And this rests on faith, a deep and profound faith, a willingness to trust the teachings that can open our heart. Shugen Roshi talked about this yesterday, the importance of faith. A willingness to deeply trust what we can't know and yet must trust. Much must reach for the offering that the Dharma is putting before us. And it's no simple thing, because we don't know. And yet, at another level deep within us, we do know. Everything in Zen practice, and ultimately in the Zen Buddhist understanding of compassion and how to manifest that, rests on the realization of emptiness and selflessness. In the most personal sense, it is a gradual practice of unselfingness, of unselfing, just letting go of ourself, letting go of our centering. That realization blossoms in finite moments and over years of sitting, practicing. That realization is real. It's not graspable with our measuring. We can't handle it. And yet it is clearly life-changing. Clearly. Out of our direct experience, it becomes real that all things arise depending on all things. The Buddha's original teaching of codependence. And that all things includes everything, no matter what those things are. Thoughts, ideas, seemingly solid things before us, calculations, all things arise through causes and conditions. And therefore, because they arise and disappear as those causes and conditions change, which they're endlessly doing, they have no permanent singular nature, no independent nature standing by itself. In other words, they're truly fundamental of a fixed existence. And that points directly to ourselves, doesn't it? Because we live as if we are this, not that, and I am this, and you are that. And that's the way it is. Thank you very much. Next. Realizing this for ourselves in a deep way, in an ongoing way of practice, in a reaffirming way of continuous practice, is the basis for wisdom and ultimately compassion for all beings who, after all, are empty of fixed characteristics, just like us. Not just within the narrow perspective of our lives, confirmed by our ongoing habitual thoughts and judgments and feelings, which are so heavily conditioned. But by an ever-deepening sense that within the particulars of this small moment, all of our life is present. Past, present, and life to be. Right here, right now. In this moment, what is past, what is present, and then what is future is here as you right now. So the hermit, who was a successor of Master Uman, he of direct pointing and short, pithy Dharma questions, holds up their staff, directly bringing forth the absolute basis. Why didn't they consent to remain here? It's an interesting question. We practice with all of our effort and intensity and desire and suffering to realize this, which is not a singular event, by the way, but an ongoing practice. So why did the Buddha arise from his sitting upon his great enlightenment? Why? The answer is right here, right in your seat, right in the zendo, right where we are. That's why. You're here because the Buddha stood up and stepped into his life. That's why. Stepped into your life. You wouldn't have been here without it, I would fairly safely predict. And of course, the Buddha is not the only one. The hermit is another example, and on and on and on from there. For every realized person, teacher or not, who offers their life out of the Dharma, for every practitioner, senior, beginning, who offers their life out of the Dharma. In other words, you. So why didn't they consent to remain here? The assembly was silent. The hermit, again in the tradition of Uman, answered in their stead and saying, because they would have no power on the road. This is, of course, the question before each of us, because we're all practicing. When session is over, whether you're in residency or not, you're on the road, so to speak. It's the question at the center of Ango. Why are we talking about the paramitas anyway? Aren't they relative? Aren't they traits that we kind of study? On the road, in the midst of your life, what is your Dharma power? Where is the energy, the virya, the aspiration of your practice, when all the props, the support of Zazen, of the teachers, of the talks, of the cultivation of a quiet and peaceful mind? Maybe that's not your experience currently, but if you keep going, it will be. What is your Dharma power when all those things are not before us? You're out on the road, when you're anxious, when you're fearful. So take away all the mind props and leave us standing naked within the myriad peaks. At such a time, what will you rely on? How do you walk straight on a winding road filled with sharp curves? Because that's our life, right? Always something. Never nothing. You'd be bored stiff if it was never nothing. I mean, it's always something. And if it's not there, we're going to make it up anyway. So a road of powerful emotions, that can arise out of our fear and anxiety, out of our numbness, out of our aggression, out of our passivity, out of endless subtle desires, under our accepted masks of safety that we so easily slip into. See my mask? And perhaps so habitually familiar that we may not even be aware of the caves we hide in. It's the power of Sangha, right? You come into the Sangha and you act out of that and it gets reflected back to you. Usually in a way that's helpful if you're willing. And that's a process for everybody. Nobody escapes alive in that way. So in the end, how is it? The hermit answered in their place, with the staff across my shoulders, paying other people no heed, I go straight into the 1,000 and 10,000 peaks. Why is the staff across their shoulder? Why do all the paramitas rest on the inherent wisdom that we are cultivating realization of? Where is the cultivation of prajna, the cultivation of seeing into your already present inherent wisdom in the 10,000 peaks on the road that you're walking? In these moments, how do you understand the success or failure of these challenges to your practice? That's an interesting question, which seems to automatically come up in our self-judgment, right? I'm failing. I can't keep my breath in front of me for more than 2 seconds. I'm up to 38 in my counting. My mind is over there, over there, over there. I don't know where my own mind is. It's moving so quick. How do you understand that? Is there success or failure within Dharma practice? If so, what determines that? And how is that measured? Everyone in this room probably, I would pretty safely guess, has often thought of their practice and their response to challenges in a successful or failing way. It's called being a human being, right? Self-judgment. But could success or failure be two sides of the same coin, determined by how you respond to the moment of difficulty, of failing or succeeding? Is there success or failure in this, or can there be a willingness to be here with this, in the moment of this? Can there be a willingness to see the mind of success and failure and be present with it? Just be present with it. Just seeing it. Because in just seeing it, it has no inherent existence. It thins out immediately in just seeing it. Where would it grab a hole other than in your habitual way of looking at yourself and others? It's no small thing. Can you fully enter the moment of your life with present awareness that does not rest in success or failure and acknowledges when you habitually look at one or the other? You know, if you always think you're successful, you're an egotist, right? So successful with that particular. If you always think of yourself as failing, you're an egotist. Same ego, right? Push it up, push it down. Either way, it's about you. Doesn't matter. just how you've lived your life in that conditioned way. To put this another way, how do we cultivate our power on the road? When we closely look at the paramitas, they may seem linear. So I want to talk about that a bit. I mean, the cultivation of generosity and patience, not so difficult to get some sense of, right? I remember when I first read of the paramitas a long time ago, and I kind of dismissed them because they're not zazen, so I thought. You know, they're psychological supports that I don't actually think I need, asshole that I was. Well, the study of the energies of bodhicitta as in virya, or a sense of morality. Sure, I can read the precepts and get it. And wisdom, prajna, which all the paramitas rest on. What does that mean? Don't know, but okay. Provisionally, I hear those words. Yet it always comes down to how do we cultivate our power on the road? I remember so clearly in my mind, I'd been practicing a while. I was pretty far along in my koan study. I was working with a different center. And I had, I thought, some pretty clear understanding of the Dharma. And yet I understood my life had not fundamentally transformed. I was still pursuing the same things I was pursuing. I was still using my life in very particular ways that were satisfying to me. But don't get in my way because I'm going to run you over. Etc., etc., etc. It comes down to how do we cultivate our power? Change the word power to dharma on the road. How does our life transform from a me-centered perspective that we all know and in some ways love to the path of a bodhisattva? We can study in many different ways. We can read the material. I love to read, so I can read about the paramitas. I can outline it, perhaps read it over and over again, so we can become more sensitive to each paramita in our life. We can carefully study it and take it in, so it becomes so familiar, we are it. Breathing it in, breathing it out. We can sit with the paramita. Breathing it in, breathing it out. So we don't advance to it, but it becomes us. That's the level that these paramitas function at. And you just don't, this doesn't come easily. You just don't grab it. And yes, you have to work it, really work it. But at some point, you have to give up the thought of working it. You have to abandon yourself to each paramita for it to work deeply within you. And that's how your life transforms. That's how it does. It's not casual. This is the entryway into seeing into the koan of your life. Are we aware that each of us face koans every day? You know, in koan practice, as I experience it in the Sangha and probably other Sanghas, it's not that popular anymore. And I have my own theories about that. It's intimidating to go before a teacher with a koan, starting with mu and working on there, being told, no, go deeper. And go, what the? Go deeper, I'm deep. But it's not yet seeing it. And so we live in a life which doesn't invite that. And I'm not saying koans are better than shikantaza. I've done more shikantaza in my practice than koan study. Either way, it ultimately relies on what you bring to it. But understand that when I say that we face the koans of our life, we face the space between being intimate with what is in front of us and not being intimate. And that lack of intimacy is called dukkha. That's what it is. And it's all over the place. It's every place you look. So when we're deeply immersed in a challenging moment, such moments can blossom as non-separation or invoke a subtle or not subtle fight or flight response, right? Anxiety-producing response. And that's okay. Either way is okay. What happens then? What happens then? And there's very different karma from those two different perspectives of going towards or running away from what is before us. Because inevitably, we're going to face things in our life that we can't run away from. And when we try and run away from it, it follows us. Sometimes immediately, sometimes years later. It's the wonder of studying karma, right? I look back on my life and I see that some of the decisions I made or where I put my energies, which made complete sense at the time, and without any clue as to the results that have come yet years or decades later and affected other people. Oh, I can't directly change those decisions then, but I can hold that karma as my karma and let it embrace me fully. Get out of the way of it instead of fighting it. This is real. I'm not giving you specific examples because you have your own specific examples. Sometimes a koan arises in our intimate relationships, sometimes at work, sometimes in facing our own karmic debts and the results of past decisions. How do we see into a koan? As I said, if we flee, it chases us. Even if we think we've hidden away from the karma, we haven't. Karmically, there's no hiding from ourselves. And yes, there's a timing to see into these life koans. There are appropriate moments when our questions can offer some insight and generosity to our being, which we can then move into and offer to others. That's called wisdom. One presentation of wisdom that this practice offers us. Insight into some life koans come easily. Others are before us for years or decades or a lifetime. And so what we have is the cultivation of patience. What does patience really mean when you investigate it? It's subtle and profound. How do you understand patience from a non-dual perspective? It's easy, I'll be patient. That's not, we may start there, we may have to start there, but that's not what's being pointed at. Bodhicitta energy, virya. How do we understand? Well, we are energy. Our life is energy. And we kind of know that. I mean, you look at any person and you get their energy. And they look at you and they get your energy. Generosity. What does it mean to truly be generous? Ethical conduct. We have the precepts. And I've already said it's easy to look at them and go, oh yeah, I won't steal. I don't steal. Want to bet? Zazen and the concentration and openness that arises out of Zazen and wisdom. This non-dual dharma, this intimacy of you as your life with all that you encounter. And we investigate this on the road in our life because if they're not taken up in our life on a moment-to-moment basis, they're useless. They're just another understanding in my catalog of endless understandings. Thank you very much. I'm well-read. I remember someone once said to me a long time ago, thankfully, boy, you know more about Buddhism than anyone else that I've met. And I thought, boy, am I being insulted? I don't want to know more about Buddhism. I want to know. I want to know, truly know. But that's how I approached it. So we study, we memorize, we read, we listen to the teachings, and most importantly, we sit. 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 With care. Consider where we find ourselves, not with a weighted judgment, but with integrity. We consider that rests in selflessness and profound honesty. We can do that. That may not be our habit, but we can do that. And we have the Sangha to help us. We have these teachings to help us. We have our teachers to help us. We have our life, which is always pointing, to help us. So we place our staff across our shoulders and walk into our life, trusting our bodhisattva intentions. That's why we chant that, to keep reminding us there's no final stopping point. There's no final vow. It has to keep being renewed and brought up because we're pretty deluded. We're pretty conditioned. And so we have to keep looking at that. There's no stopping in this process. The verse to this koan. Their eyes are all dust and sand, their ears all dirt. They dare not stay among the 1,000 and 10,000 peaks. Falling blossoms, flowing waters, incessantly busy. Raising their eyebrows, where are they going? One of the most, to me, exciting perspectives of our study of koans, especially the koans of our life, but koans, is whenever we think we've seen deeply into our life, with time and ongoing practice, we may open up to a much broader perspective and understanding beyond our past insights. I'm just thinking how I viewed my stepmother when I was a child, which was not with generosity and compassion. And I could justify that. How I viewed her when I got a little older. How I viewed her when I encountered for the first time a full backstory and had some understanding of why she was how she was. And how I viewed her in her old age when she asked me to come to Arizona. And when I said, why? She said, just come. And she apologized to me. A woman I never thought was capable of doing that. How we might see into Mu, and how we understand that initially, and how we might see that understanding later in our practice, is usually going to be very different. And you can apply that to many aspects of our practice. And the same is true of the challenges of our life. How we see or don't see a significant event in our lives, and how we understand the same event later, can be very, very different. The verse to this koan points in this way. Their eyes are all dust and sand, their ears are all dirt. What do you think is being pointed at here? There is an innocence, no polish at all, so plain when there is nothing you need to cling to. It reminds me of how honest we look for residents during Ango. You know, we don't have quite the time to take as many showers as we like. We're tired. Can't afford to look pretty. And of course, at the end of Sesshin, every face is like that. Every face shines. Because our energy is going in a different direction than it often does. And a direction that's much more important than whether I look pretty or not. So their eyes are all dust and sand, their ears all dirt. Your eyes, your ears. Stains on a shirt, dust in their ears. Look closely at the 10th ox herding picture downstairs. What do you see? Someone dressed to the nines? Someone who's proud and on display? What is essential is clearly present. There's no pretty picture going on here. Master Nan Chuan said, such fools and dullards are extremely rare. Rare because they're not deceived by others, by popular culture, by others' judgments of their being cool or right or not. They dare not stray among the thousand and 10,000 peaks. Whatever you see into, see it clearly and then let it go. Don't stay or your life dies. Don't hang on to some insight. So they don't stay among the 1,000 and 10,000 peaks. And where are those 10,000 peaks anyway? Over there? Up that mountain? Over here? Right now, where do you find yourself? Falling blossoms, flowing waters, incessantly busy. All of our being, all of our experiences, all of our understandings are constantly changing if we allow it, if we get the hell out of the way. Incessantly busy, that's our life. Are we with it, in it, of it, apart from it? Raising their eyebrows, where are they going? Wherever they're going, the staff and the paramitas can support us. That's our practice. And as we more deeply trust this, we find that our true nature, who we fundamentally are, has always been right here. Always been right here. Right here. Radiating to all beings. And then, although there is a path, there's no map. We can practice, we can realize our bodhisattva vows and practice them to awaken and offer this life among the 10,000 peaks. But it must be ours, yours, you, in your individual karma and life, not anybody else's. That's what you got. That's your gift. What a gift. What a wonderful gift. There's no accomplishment here. There's no particular place where we are. In this way, our life is just as it is. Nothing special. Just as it is. How truly remarkable.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.